Good evening, everyone. Let me just—it's August 25th, 2020. This is class 14.
Wow.
We're having a good time. At least as I'm getting a few emails a week from people with comments and questions. So thank you. And for Mr. Five Towns, I'll get to your issue on the kashrus again. Not this week. I keep pushing it off, but it's the sort of thing. It's okay. I want to respond to a few things, and then. Continue. We're going to finish with Yoredeya today because we only have two more responsa, and then we'll start with Evan Ezer. I mentioned last class that Eisenstadt, and a few of you have been on our tours, that was an independent city, so some Jewish town. So someone says, "Well, what do I mean in the past? What do I mean independent Jewish town? It was a city. You can go on your Wikipedia. You can read about it. The Esterhazy family owned this city, and there's a palace there." Right near the Jewish quarter, Haydn lived there. They have a Haydn festival every year. He was the musician for the family. So what do I mean by that? And also Boskovitz, which is the town of Rav Nosson Adler when he was thrown kicked out of Frankfurt. Okay, so let me explain. It's sort of like if you're in New York, you might know Kiryas Yoel. It's like what Kiryas Yoel to Monroe is what these Jewish sections are. In 1848, the feudal system was abolished in Austria-Hungary, and a number of Jewish communities in various towns in Austria-Hungary became independent municipalities, I guess. And Eisenstadt itself was called Unterberg-Eisenstadt. Now, by 1876, most of the Jewish communities were not able to remain independent, but three remained independent. When I say independent, I mean their own mayor, their own, well, they didn't have police chief, but they could have, their own town. Boskovitz even had its own fire chief. I don't know what they did. Now, the three were Mattersdorf, Boskovitz, and Eisenstadt. On our trip, we go to Boskovitz and Eisenstadt. Mattersdorf is known because that's where the Chasam Sofer first went before he went to Pressburg. In 1903, Mattersdorf joined the regular community. Boskovitz was independent until 1919. Eisenstadt remained an independent town, and because it was an independent town, those who are with us remember you could they used to shut it for Shabbos. When Israel Hildesheimer was there, they established the first yeshiva, I guess, with secular studies in the West. That was an independent town, and that remained independent till 1938, August of 1938. That's a few months after the Anschluss. The Anschluss, when Austria becomes part of Germany. Eisenstadt was a part of Nazi Germany. And from March until August 1938, Eisenstadt, as part of Nazi Germany, contained a Jewish, independent, autonomous town with its own Jewish officials. And it's a completely striking thing, as I mentioned a few questions ago, Eisenstadt today, you see the old cemetery is still there. They didn't destroy it. The president of Austria, I think, I forget his name, Heinisch, he was president in the 20s. He visited Eisenstadt and is said to have mentioned, and he was correct, that Eisenstadt is the last independent Jewish town in the world. And it was. Today, I think in Canada, you have Tush, outside of Montreal, and you have Kiryas Yoel, and okay, so that's what I meant by that. I said the last class that the Brisker Rav's great concern was in opposing Zionism was matters of life and death. Just like Rav Henkin said, they were afraid that if they declared a state, then there would lead to killing of many Jews. So someone said, well, that implies that he wasn't anti-Zionist. No, he was anti-Zionist. I've spoken about this so many times, I didn't feel the need to mention it. Let me go back. His main reason for opposing, before everything else, was that he thought that the Zionists were going to destroy Torah. He didn't believe that it was possible to be a Jew living under Zionists, secularists, et cetera, et cetera. However, even if it was a religious Zionist, he still opposed it because he said that it would get the Arabs would launch a war and many Jews would be killed. I spoke a couple classes ago about, hold on, let me pull up this picture here. I'm gonna have to hold on, I'll pull it up again. About Moshe Blau. I don't know what happened to his picture here, but I'm going to show it to you again. Here it is. Let me put your picture on the screen here. Here we go. This is Moshe Blau on the left. And I mentioned him because he was the leader of Agudas Yisrael in Eretz Yisrael, and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook said about him that his father, Rav Kook, said that the land should spit him out, and he died, remember, in Italy, because he was the head of the Aguda, which did such terrible things to Rav Kook. I want to pull up something else in a second here, and I don't want to have sound on my other computer here. And I also said that I thought it was... it's a little strange because he was a pragmatist, and to speak so terribly about him, it seemed to me like it was a little bit unfair. I've been reading over Shabbos more in this book, which is all about, it's called Perud Hishtatfut, Agudas Yisrael, Opposite Zionism. And I have to tell you that I'm more and more impressed with Moshe Blau when I really see where it's Tzvi Yehuda Kook, the way he spoke about him is inappropriate, although I understand why he did that. Why do I say that? I mean, it's throughout the book, but just on page 199, you read about they had negotiations with the Mizrahi about having a joint organization to work for Torah in the land of Israel. The story is the same as always. He had to back out because the extremists in Jerusalem found out about it, and he was afraid. So you can say that he had no courage, which is true. He didn't have courage, perhaps. But to say that he was like this evil person, it happened under his watch, all these terrible things. I get it. But if you look in his biography, in his autobiography, he refers to Rav Kook as Zichrono Livracha. I understand why Rav Tzvi Yehuda was so upset, but he really was a big pragmatist. And the real question is, if he had lived, he died in 46, and the state was declared, would he have gone with Agudas Yisrael? Or would he have remained with Rabbi Dushinsky and the old Yishuv and remained an anti-Zionist? We don't know the answer to that. But I do have to say, knowing the circumstances he was in and the crazies he had to deal with, all in all, I admire him, the way he tried to solve these problems. I'm not sympathetic to Rav Tzvi Yehuda's strong attacks on him. Oh, one more point. It's interesting, again, how much we do in these classes come up just during the week. In last week's Ramazuz's Parsha sheet, and a few of you at least I know now are reading it because you asked me for it and I signed you up on it. He says, he's speaking about women and the 100 brachos a day we have to do, we're supposed to do, and are women obligated? And he explains that women are not obligated in this. And he says, how could women be obligated? Because women don't daven. Tamid nagusha nashim modit palot. He says, women don't daven. Etc. So if you recall, we already had Shuvot, we dealt with this with the role of women, and I mentioned how that's a completely different thing. Women's spirituality today, call it feminism, call it more attentive to the actual halakha, which it is, that women daven today. But the idea that this is like basic and has always been is not the case, and in many church societies it still is not. Compare this. It's a very interesting comparison. I just was curious, and I took out again the OU statement on women's spiritual leaders. And they talk about how you need to have women be involved in Torah study and everything, but they can't be rabbis, etc. Right at the end, page 16, they speak about how women seek to intensify their tefillah experience. They're talking about women in our, well, I shouldn't say our communities, because we have people listening now. I can see by the names. We have Borough Park, we have Muncie, we have all sorts of types. And then it says, the importance of tefillah for women and men must be stressed, and efforts must be undertaken by communal leadership to create an environment and feel experience that will engage every individual. And then it goes on, you have to construct a machitza that is sensitive to the degree of engagement with women. They should be included in conversations related to tefillah, et cetera, et cetera. So that is a huge change from what traditionally it was. The idea years ago, we would ask women what they thought about where they were sitting and davening. So that's a positive thing. And but it isn't, I just don't like when people make it as if this comes out of the sources of tradition. Sure, you could find things, but what happened is that women started becoming more involved, and they started learning, and they wanted to go to shul, and therefore, if it's not a violation of halacha, then it should be made applicable. But it's a very big difference than what we've seen in other communities. Also, I think it's of note that although they talk about how well it's important to have women as scholars and residents and teachers of Torah and everything, this document, 16 pages, is only signed by men. Only male rabbis sign it, which leads me to understand, even though it's written more as like a position paper, it's really not halacha, it's about halacha ethos and everything. They regard this as a halachic responsum, because they say that women are not supposed to be involved in making halachic responsa, halachic rulings, and therefore it's all in all, I think the document's a good document, and I mean mostly I would agree with it, but it's a little bit, they never explain in certain areas why they come to certain conclusions, and it is striking, I think, that no women, if it's all about roles of women, you think they would have been able to find women who agree with this sort of basic ideology in the document. If you don't know what I'm referring to, I can save it to you. It's the OU's statement about the roles of women and what they can and cannot do in the synagogue in order to be an OU synagogue, I guess. Okay, everyone, we are now picking up where we left off, and we're in Yoredeya, Siman, section. Section page 135, section 59. And here I need to introduce you to a person we've spoken about a few once, I think. But let me remind you again who he is, and that is this individual, Rabbi Chaim Rappaport of London, well-known speaker in America as well. He's author of numerous works. He was a Rosh Kollel in Leeds, a Big Talmid Chacham, of course. Here is one of his works. It's a sefer on Birkas Kohanim. But that's not known. He wrote this book, Judaism and Homosexuality, An Authentic Orthodox View. We spoke about that already. I mentioned that it's a sort of, I guess you could say it's a little behind the times. Because today, some of the things he says, there are many people in the communities who are not happy with that he's not as, I guess, accepting of homosexuality in practice. But that's it's an important work, and anyone who's interested in the topic, I highly recommend it. He also wrote a number of other writings. Here's one. This is an attack on David Berger. Messiah problem, Berger. It's called The Angel and the Scandal of Reckless Indiscrimination, because David Berger wrote a book called The Scandal of Orthodox Indifference, and then he wrote this work, which is a response to Samuel Heilman and late Menachem Friedman's book on the Lubavitch Rebbe. Quite a thick book. It has an approbation, a preface by Elliot Wolfson, the great Elliot Wolfson. So that he has a lot to say. I include the letters here. The first one is, before you even get to the letter to me, it's a letter he put on the Svarim blog, which is then, it's addressed basically to me, although it's to the editors of the Svarim blog, and then he has his letter to me. The title of this section is called The Rambam's View When It Comes to Amulets, Shemos HaKadoshim, and Holy Names, or maybe Holy Names in quotations. So first, what is the Svarim blog? Probably a lot of you already know about it. It's a blog that was started, I think, in 2006. I became involved with it in 2007. I don't have any official role because I don't want it, but I do have an unofficial. I'm involved in reading posts and doing all sorts of other things, even have helped raise some money for it. It's a very popular blog. Each post will get 4 or 5 thousand readers, so you see that it's quite popular. I don't know. I hear a little bit of background. All right, Kelman, if you could see if there's anyone who's still, we can shut everyone's sound off. It's a blog, although most of the writers are Orthodox, and there's an Orthodox sort of sensibility. It's not an Orthodox blog. There's been a number of people who are non-Orthodox who post on it, and I can tell you that there are comments from the non-Orthodox as well. If you're interested at all in Sfarim, I highly recommend it. It's run, I'm going to pull up right now, it's run by a person in Silver Spring who started it, named Dan Rabinowitz. He's a lawyer, but he also is a scholar. Let me show you what he published. What he published began as a post on the blog. I highly recommend this work. He published The Lost Library. It's a study of the Strachan Library, which is the great library of Vilna, and after the war. Really, it's a quick read, a very enjoyable read. You can, on the Library of, if you Google his name on YouTube, you can hear a talk of his on the Library of Congress website. So how did I get involved with it? Well, I have a great and long interest in Sfarim and books. And when blogs were first starting, this was an opportunity, I thought, to publish things, small things, zutot, they're called in Hebrew. There's even a journal called Zutot for Small Things, which would reach large audiences, and I could use a different media. So, for example, videos and pictures and all sorts of unusual stuff, which you can't really put it in a regular academic article. And I've been writing ever since. I have about 2,000 pages already written on it, and everyone's invited to look at it. More people, I think, read it than read my books. So there was some discussion on the blog about the Rambam's view of various superstitions and things of that nature. So Rabbi Rappaport sent an article. And one more point I need to make, Rabbi Rappaport. He's an expert in what we call melitza. Melitza is a way of writing Hebrew. It used to be very common. Today, it's not so common. Everyone used to do it in the olden days. It's with a flowery Hebrew. If you look at the Rishonim, the way they write, mostly the Sephardic Rishonim, the Rambam also. Look at some of his letters to the sages of southern France and others. These people knew Tanakh backwards and forwards, that they were able to write 15 sentences in a row, 20, 30, each one using a biblical verse. It's hard to imagine how they were able to do that. And there's still people who can do that, not to that great extent, but it's still a skill. It really survived in the Sephardic world. Melitza sort of changed, though, because if you look at Melitza today, it's not so much anymore usually of using different biblical verses. When I say using biblical verses, look at the Rishonim that are annotated. You'll see they have a footnote after each line, and it says, I'll pee this verse. You know, they're using this verse, that verse. Today, melitza is often used rhyming and use of biblical expressions. The Chidah, I'm not going to say he innovated it, Chaim Yosef Barzilai, but he really pushed forward a new type of melitza where you take words and you change one letter and then it means something else. You could say it's a game, perhaps, but it's some people really love it. Let me give you an example of this, which I mentioned in a recent post myself. So, for instance, I found in a... I just found this. I was putting up this post about a month ago, or just a few days before. I found in this sefer by a rabbi of from Bulgaria, believe it or not, Sofia. But he's from Salonika. His name is Pipanu, is his name. And he wrote Avnei HaEfod and some other Sfarim. And at the beginning of the book, like the first page, after the title page, this is what appears. It's his introduction. So what is this? What do these words mean even? Well, this is melitza, and I could give you so many examples of it. The melitza is, it says, Aleph Reish Shin, that should be read Eresh, Kedem. So what is Eresh? This is a play on Eretz. The Torah speaks about Eretz Kedem. So this is Eresh Kedem. And if you notice, sometimes they do this next to the Reish. Let me enlarge this if I can a bit. Between the Reish and the Dalid, yeah, here, I'll show you. There's a little line. That's the signal that what he's doing is he's playing on a biblical verse. So instead of saying Hakdama, he says Eresh Kedem. What is Eresh? Eresh, I think we'll be saying it in a few weeks if you still sing, remember? Areshes. If I say, we know the tune. Areshes means from speech. So Eresh Kedem means speech of introduction. That's a melitza. And you go, so the Sfaradim are very big into this melitza. There's a, incidentally, Rav Yaakov Emden has a work on the Siddur, and this is the name of the work. So how do you pronounce it? What does it even mean? This is a play on, there's a biblical expression, Luach Arez, Arez. It should be, but it's the end of a word, so it's Arez. So instead, he plays on it, he makes it Luach Eresh. Although the HebrewBooks.org here has an Aresh, he has an Aresh because in Tanakh it's Arez, but that's not true. It's Eresh, just like Rav Yisrael Zalman Meltzer's work, even though it's Evan HaEzel, even though in Tanakh it's Evan HaAzel, because we're speaking, we're not, it's not a pasuk what we're doing. If you go online and just search, you'll see that a very big scholar, I don't want to say the name, but you can find it very easily if you Google, refers to this work as Luach Eres. I don't even know what Luach Eres is supposed to mean. What is Eres? I guess Eres could be like to be engaged, because the Sin and the Samech are exchanged, but that's not what it is. It has nothing to do with Eres. The name of it's from it's Eresh, because of that word speech. And you can give numerous examples. If you look in some of my early works I tried writing in Hebrew, I tried to write Melitza. Why? I don't know. It sounds fun. If you look, if you have my introduction, for instance, to Saul Lieberman, the Orthodox, take a look there. I refer to Cambridge, Massachusetts as Ha'ir Kiryat Sefer. So if you know Hebrew, you see that's a Melitza, Kiryat Sefer. It doesn't mean that in Tanakh, Kiryat Sefer, doesn't mean that in the Bible, but it can mean the city of the book. Where did I make this up? No, I didn't make this up. I'm not, I'll tell you, hold on, I'll tell you where it appears. It's Kiryat Sefer. Today is a, it's a, where does it appear in, does anyone remember where in Tanakh it appears? Hold on, I'll find it here. I think it's in, where in anyone, yeah, Kiryat Sefer, it's in Yeshua. Okay, it doesn't mean the city of the book. That's definitely doesn't mean that, but that's what it can mean. So am I, do I create Melitza? Am I the Chida? Am I Ruach Chaim Rapport? No, I'm a consumer. So what do I did? For years, if you look at my early articles, I have a lot of Melitza because I collected them. When I saw them, I thought they were nice. I wrote them, I have a whole list of them. And then when I wrote an article, I found places to stick them in. And there's all sorts of cute Melitzas. There's a scholar in Israel wrote to me, couldn't believe I know all the, I'm writing like real Melitza. It's nothing, it's no big chachma. It's just you, after you're done the article, you stick it in, you find places where they are. And then I found a great work. I love this book. Haketav HaMichtav. This comes out of Rav Mazuza's yeshiva. Look how thick it is. It's all about how to write properly in Hebrew. And it has here pages. It must have 50 pages of Melitzot. What you do in every circumstance, when you're writing to someone who's ill, when you're writing to someone whose name is Moshe, when you're writing to someone to thank him, when you're writing to someone to praise him, when you're writing to someone, here, I just opened it up. When someone has a daughter, what you say to him, what you say at the time of the bris, at a chasana, et cetera, et cetera. So anytime you want to make people think that you're really smart and you know all these melitzas, you can pick up this book and it's full of great stuff. It's called Haketav VeHaMichtav. And Rabbi Rappaport's an expert on this. So there was someone who criticized me for in my book, Limits of Orthodox Theology, for expressing surprise that Ramosha Feinstein writes that the Rambam held that holy names, names of angels, all these sorts of things could protect you. When Rambam, obviously, if you know his philosophy, doesn't believe in this, and we'll see what the Vilna Gaon says about this. But someone expressed surprise at me for saying that and disagreed. I think because in the pop, when I say, I don't want to say popular mind, even in the rabbinic mind, if you haven't studied the philosophical writings, this is a basic concept that if you use the God's holy name and names of angels and things like that, you can do magic, you can do all sorts of other things. So Rabbi Rappaport, in the first section of his letter, defends what I say and provides other proofs of this. He quotes Rav Yaakov Emden, who attacks the Rambam for this view. And that's the first in page 136, he says, we see from Yaakov Emden, the Rambam didn't believe in the koach of shemot, of names. He totally rejected that. And the Yaakov Emden says that's because the Rambam didn't know about Kabbalah. But then he says, and he added this on to the original letter, he included the letter he wrote to me. As he says, he includes the letter he wrote to me, Katsurato Katsalmo. That's also a good Melitza Dick. He includes his letter. And in his letter to me, however, he said he acknowledges that the Rambam obviously did not believe in this sort of thing. However, when I criticized, when I expressed surprise with Rav Moshe, I called attention to two places in the Rambam's writings. And Rabbi Rapoport says, the only thing those places in the Rambam's writings refer to are names, but not the Shema Mefarash. Rav Moshe says holy names, so we still don't know that the Shema Mefarash, the Tetragrammaton, or some other special name of God that you can interpret, he says, the Rambam as only referring to in those, if you want to read him literally, when he speaks about people who use the name of God, they're only using false names of God, not the real name of God. And that's his, although he doesn't believe this, the case, he said the question is only, does the Rambam explicitly mention this or not? And he says he doesn't see that. My response to him was as follows, that first of all, I'm not saying anything new here. The Vilna Gaon already said this. Let me show you the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon. I have it here from the Vilna Gaon's. I'm going to enlarge it to you. This is the Vilna Gaon's commentary. This is the first printing in Grodno in 1808 of the Vilna Gaon's commentary on the Shulchan Aruch. This is the most famous comment of the Vilna Gaon in his commentary, where in Yud Gimel, after the Shulchan Aruch, believe it or not, mentions an idea that comes out of the Rambam that sort of denies the supernatural. The Vilna Gaon says, Kol habayim macharav, everyone who came after the Rambam, chalak alav, sharei harbei lachashim nemru b'gemara. There are many incantations in the Gemara. Then he says, v'hu nimshach achar ha-philosophy ha-rura. The Vilna Gaon says that the Rambam was led astray by the accursed philosophy. If you look at the Shulchan Aruch you have at home, unless you have the brand new Machon Yerushalayim, that word Arura will not be found. When the standard Vilna Shulchan Aruch that we all had for so many years was printed originally, they took out the word Arura. The Vilna Ram publishers were very close to Maskilim, religious Haskalah. But they rejected this idea that the Rambam, because there was a legend that the Vilna Gaon never said this, that it was put in. We know that's not true. We know that we have testimony that it's the actual, comes directly from the handwriting. So it should be philosophy Aurora, V'achen kasaf shekshafim b'shemas v'achshim b'shedim, etc. Hakohu sheker. Therefore, the Vilna Gaon tells us, because the Rambam was led astray by philosophy, he rejects all these things, incantations and magic and demons and names, holy names, the idea that you can do magic and all sorts of things with God's name. And then I say that the Igros Moshe says that there is Shemira, that you can be protected by the names of angels and holy names. And the Rambam, in his commentary in the Mishnah, rejects this idea that you can use any, he says he rejects the idea, he even calls them tipshim. He says they're stupid people who write kameot and put inside them shemosh kadoshim and the names of angels and all that. And the Rambam thinks, and that's what a kameya is. The definition of a kameya, an amulet, is when you put something, you make something with these special names. People used to make mezuzahs. And they, in medieval Ashkenaz, they put holy names in everything, in the mezuzah. And that's the definition of when they speak about holy names, they're speaking about all of them. So I acknowledge that I should have said, I could have added that the Rambam never states explicitly about the Tetragrammaton, but that's not what people speak about. They're talking, or the 72 letter name of God. The Rambam is speaking about these people who use names that they think are holy. And the Rambam doesn't believe that the mezuzah gives you protection. He doesn't believe in that whole concept that check your mezuzahs, it gives you protection. If you look in Rav Kafach's commentary, he says, it does give you protection. The best protection is that when you go in and out, you see the mezuzah and it reminds you of God. And that's protection, not a magical protection. So I would say that the letters, the report of my letter, it really, I guess it speaks to the idea that the Rambam has to be seen not just from his halachic writings. It's amazing how many poskim have looked in the Mishnah Torah and concluded that he must believe in demons and all sorts of things without looking in his other writings. That's Siman Nuntes. And there's more we could talk about in the Rambam, obviously, but we'll leave it at that. On Siman Samach, we return to another rabbi that we spoke about, and that's this one. Hold on. No, not the... Where is he? Here, Rabbi Ratzabi, the great Yemeni posek. I would think perhaps the leading Yemeni posek today in Israel. I turned to him again about a different matter. This gets us back to something we spoke about last week, living in Egypt. I mean, instead of traveling to Egypt. So what's my fixation with Egypt here? It actually began when I was a yeshiva student in Israel, 1984 to 1985. Was what, 6 years or 5 years after the peace treaty of Egypt and Israel. I was interested in going to Egypt. Now, in those days, you could do all sorts of things. My son is leaving to Yeshiva tomorrow. He just got something a couple of days ago, a contract. And one of the things on it is that you're not allowed to leave Israel without permission. And they will only give you permission if you're going to see family. I don't know, this year, I don't know if they would do any permission because you have to quarantine when you come back. But this is every year. You can't leave. I can't imagine any yeshiva today allowing someone to go to Egypt or even maybe go out of the country if you're not meeting your family anywhere. In my year in Israel, it wasn't an issue. We didn't even, it wasn't a problem. How do I know that? Because I remember very vividly, it became a dispute, a little dispute in the Beis Medrash. And this is the first of my journeys, which has now led to our Torah in Motion tours that, God willing, soon we'll be able to continue again. I decided, I'm only 18 years old, that I want to go to Egypt. I don't recall if I asked my parents. I don't know if I did. Maybe I did. I can tell you that if my son were to ask me if he can go, I'd say absolutely not. An 18-year-old going there. So I needed to get, I wasn't going to go myself. So I asked around the Beis Medrash, and this was, in those days, you had two big tours. The first was around Sukkot time. We went in the south. And then before Pesach in Nisan, they went up north. So I tried to find students and said that instead of going on the tour, we can just do our own thing. In other words, it wasn't an issue that we could do that. And today they would never allow something like that, at least not the yeshivas that I know about. Maybe some others would, but my son's yeshiva definitely wouldn't let you just leave and not go. And no one, very few were willing to come with me. Probably they asked their parents, and their parents said, "You crazy? What are you going to Egypt?" I arranged everything, and I was able to get four people to come with me. So let me show you the four people who I was able to get to come with me. Oops, sorry. Here they are. We went. I arranged it. We took a bus through the Sinai. We went there. On the right is Yosef Moseri. If we have any people from the Syrian community, he's a teacher of Torah now in Brooklyn. If you Google him, you'll see he's been teaching Torah there for probably 20 years. We all look a little different. In the middle is Jeff Eisenberg, if anyone knows him from the Five Towns. On the left is David Dessau. Mel from Highland Park, you must know David Dessau. And there I am in the middle. Moseri, it was good to have him because he's from Egyptian background. His parents were from Egypt. He was able to make connections for us. In those days, there still were Jews there. The shul was still used. I heard from Daniel Kurtzer in the 90s when he was ambassador, they still would have synagogue on Shabbos. They didn't always get a minyan, but they still would have shul on Shabbos. And incidentally, Rabbi Kelman, Daniel Kurtzer, that might be an interesting speaker as well. And you had Zakheim being, you know, a Orthodox Jew in Egypt and Israel, you know, diplomacy might be interesting. Moseri was arranged. We were taken to one of the old shuls and they brought us in, and there was like 20 Sifrei Torah there. But they explained that they couldn't take it out. It was considered heritage of Egypt, and I don't know where these Sifrei Torah, they're probably is still there. Okay, so what happened was that someone started telling us, when I got my four people, my three people and me together, we couldn't go to Egypt because it's Usser. And I knew it wasn't Usser. I knew that it was only Usser to live, according to the Rambam, permanently in Egypt. And even, we don't even hold like the Rambam. The big question is how the Rambam lived in Egypt, because he says, we'll see what Rav Kook says in a second, which could be an answer for the Rambam, but the Rambam says you can't live in Egypt. The standard view was there's all these different heterin. Either it's not the same Egyptians, or either it only means you have to return the same way. There's all different heterin. You can Google it and you can find it. But some guy, at the time I thought that he was just angry at us because his parents must have told him he couldn't go, so he didn't want anyone to go. So if we have our BMT people, you'll remember this. He went to Rav Benny. Rav Benny Eisner, Zichrono Livracha. Anyone who went to BMT for 25 years or more knows Rav Benny. And Rav Benny, he was very upset that we were, although he thought he was some Gush Emunim, Rav Kuknik, which he was, his father was a Musmach at the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin. I don't know what you call it. When you go to, we know the Haredi Yeshivas, you're from out or something. He did the same thing in the Merkaz world. And he looked like America's guy and was complete followers to Yehuda Kook. But he came from German Orthodox background. He was very upset. He couldn't understand why I would want to go to Egypt. You know, this is Eretz Yisrael. Every centimeter is holy. And I'm going to go to Egypt. But he told the other guy, there's no halachic problem going to Egypt. If you're not going to live there permanently, and even the Rambam doesn't hold it. Okay. So I had a great interest in Egypt and halachic issues about it, Rabbanim in Egypt, etc. A few years after we left, a few years after this trip we went on, I was studying the sugya again, and I had a question, and I wrote to Rav Atzabi. And I thought it was a good question. It's a different question than the one I asked Rabbi Feinhander. But the same halacha. The Rambam says, you can't return to Egypt. The only reason you can return, he says, is l'schora prakmatia u'kibush haaretz. You can return for business and to conquer the land. And it appears to me that it appeared to me that that's all the Rambam saying. You can, let's say you can return for business. You're a business person. You fly there, you do your business, and then you leave. However, I point out in my letter to Rav Ratzabi, if you look at all of them before you, and I did not find any commentator who disagrees, they all say, in discussing this halacha, that according to the Rambam, there's no prohibition of living in Egypt. For me, the prohibition of living in Egypt, the Torah doesn't want us to return to Egypt, and I don't need to get into all the details of why, but the Torah speaks about you're not supposed to return to Egypt. So according to the Rambam, however, all the commentators say the Rambam distinguishes between temporary dwelling, which is permitted, and permanent dwelling, which is forbidden. If you look at the Radbaz says the Rambam was, the Radbaz who himself lived in Egypt, said the Rambam was compelled to live in Egypt because of the Sultan. It's a very strange thing because the Rambam went to Egypt willingly. And what about everyone else? What about the Radbaz? Why is he living in Egypt? All the commentators make this distinction. Permanent dwelling, the Rambam says forbidden. Temporary dwelling, permitted. And let's leave aside the Rambam, how he himself lived there. My question is, where do they get this from? If you look in the Rambam, and this is based on the Yerushalmi, the Rambam is explicit. The Yerushalmi says, and that's what the Rambam says. Only for conquering and for business reasons. Where did they get this idea then that you can go as a tourist or that you can go for another reason? The Rambam is specific and the Yerushalmi is specific. And yet all the commentators assume it's a question of permanent versus temporary dwelling. And Rabbi Ratzabi explains that he explains that they're really connected. The reason is why you can't return to Egypt is because lotosifun lashuv, don't return there, and they make the drasha that yeshiva, living, dwelling there is forbidden, but simply visiting there is not forbidden. So therefore, he argues that, and not just him, he's explaining all the commentators, the Rambam is only giving examples of temporary dwelling, it's lav dafka, we could say, rabbinically. But then I asked him a different question. I found Rav Kook says something really interesting, that there's no prohibition on dwelling in Egypt when you're at Sibur. as a group. The prohibition is only on individuals, even according to the Rambam. Why? Because the Torah, Rav Kook says, was concerned that because of Egypt, the bad influence of Egypt there, the idolatry, immorality, that individuals would be negatively affected. But if you're in a community, a communal framework, you have the support of others, and that it's like what they say about kids going away to college. You know, don't send them unless there's a community there that can give them chizuk. So Rav Kook says there's no prohibition living as a group. Maybe the first people who went to Egypt sinned, but once there's already a community, you go, you live in a community, a Torah community, then we assume that you're protected by from the bad influences, and it's permissible. And that's how Rav Kook explains how not just the Rambam, but all the Jews living in Egypt, no one ever said they were doing anything problematic because there already was a kehila there. So my question was as follows. According to Rav Kook's Shita, and those who accept this chidush of his, what's the definition of a tzibur? You say a tzibur is 10? Normally we say a tzibur is 10, but can 10 people, the whole country, affect you, affect the bad influences? And second of all, I said, today in Egypt, today there might be, or not, I don't think there's even 5 Jews living in Egypt today. But then there were more. I said, I don't think that there's even 200. Jews living in Egypt. I think I used the word 200. I think it was the word. I'm not sure. Oh, yeah, 200. I said, if there's 200 Jews there, are they at Sibor? Especially, they're not. I don't think there's one Shomer Shabbos person in all of Egypt. And that was true. There was not one. When I wrote in this letter in the 1980s, there was not one Shomer Shabbos Jew in all of Egypt. Is that at Sibor? If the whole point of Rav Kook is saying, explain the Rambam, that you can dwell in Egypt in the Tzibur because the Tzibur will protect you from the bad influences, if you're dealing with people who are not religious, how can they protect you from the bad influences? They themselves are going to be influenced. So would that mean that according to the Rambam, based on this, you couldn't live in Egypt anymore? What he says, first of all, is he rejects Rav Kook's whole approach. He doesn't. Rav Kook sees two halachot here. It's two parts of it, that not to live in Egypt, and that if you're a community, you can. He rejects this. He sees this as only one issue, not to live in a community. Not to live in Egypt doesn't matter. He doesn't think this whole thing of Tzibur makes any sense. If you're attuned to certain things, you'll know that he published this in his Sefer. And he's in the Haredi world, and you see something which is disappointing, I have to say, but what can you do? He doesn't refer to Rav Kook by name. He refers to Rav Kook as Reish Aleph Kuf. So I'll know who he's talking about, and people on the inn will know who he's talking about. But the average person reading the book, they'll see they won't know who Reish Aleph Kuf is, Reish Aleph Kuf, because he doesn't want to mention Rav Kook's name. That's the sort of thing that bothers me. But what are you going to do? That's what he does. And then he says that he doesn't seem to have a problem, even if they're not religious. He says 200 people are certainly at Sibor, and look, they're Jewish. So he doesn't seem to raise the issue that if they're not Shomer Shabbos, it would be a problem. So we're left with the Rav Ratzabi denying Rav Kook's chidush, which leaves us with the problem. How did the Rambam live there? I have to say, though, that Rav Kook's, unlike what Rav Ratzabi says, Rav Kook's chidush, if you read the Rambam's writings, you could read it this way, that there's two separate things here, dwelling there as an individual and as a Robin. But I'll leave it to you if you want to investigate this more. Okay. We are now finished with Yoredeya. And now we move on to Evin Ezer. As I told you before, the book is divided into the 4 sections of Shulchan Aruch, and then into matters dealing with history and Jewish books, etc. Those who are not so interested in halakha will find those parts of great interest, but I'm trying to make even the halakha of interest to people who that's not their focus. The next responsum, number 61, there are 2 Dayanim I know of. One of them is listening to us right now from Brooklyn, who have said that this is a very radical tshuva, what we're going to do now. On the other hand, I'll read you soon what another Dayan said, that he didn't think it was so radical. So let me explain what's going on here. The title of the tshuva is Nisue Gioras Kohen Kishniskaira Bachosa Mibas Kimoshanim. Can a convert marry a Kohen if the convert, the woman, converted when she was under 3 years old? The halacha is that a convert cannot marry a Kohen. It has to do with the fact that it's assumed that the There's all sorts of sexual immorality among the non-Jewish population, and the Kohen is special in that regard. So what happened, and Chazal, they had to pick an age, so from today's standpoint, it would sound weird, 3 years old and over, but in those days, people got married very young. Also, they picked an age. They had a conception of 3 years. But under 3 years, no one's assumed there's no problems, anything like that. So the question is, can you, someone who converts as a child, be married to a Kohen? Now, this responsum is not addressed to me. Why do I include it in the book? Because Rabbi Greenblatt, this is famous Rabbi Ephraim Greenblatt, Talmud Muvak, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, he wanted to include it in volume 9 of his Rabbi Moshe Ephraim. He passed away before volume 9 came out. He says in the responsum he's going to include it in volume 9. Furthermore, he had one of his students translate it into English. And this was then distributed among various rabbis. There's a number of rabbis in America who had a copy of this. So he wanted it to be made public. So I published it. And other than the two Dayanim, and Rabbi Ari Enkin in Israel, he also writes in Halacha, no one has said anything. We've had huge Talmidei Chachamim read the book. They thought it was interesting, but didn't think it was crazy. Maybe this is because they're big Talmidei Chachamim, not Dayanim. There's often a distinction between Dayanim and Rosh Yeshiva or Talmidei Chachamim. But let's get into the meat of it. He was asked as follows. Very tough case. A man and his wife adopted a child. And when she was about a week old, they converted her. And the question he's dealing with is not an uncommon question. Many, many Orthodox synagogues have people who have adopted children who are were not Jewish and then were converted. And there's no problem doing that. Can you marry a Kohen? He goes on to say that they did not tell the daughter that she was adopted. I don't know if that's such a good thing with the psychologists to say today, but that's what they didn't do. She met a boy and was ready to get married. However, the boy is a Kohen. So now there's a problem. This is a religious family here that they realize there's a problem because a convert can't marry a Kohen. And according to the law in the Shulchan Aruch, even if you convert someone as a child at a week old, you can't marry the Kohen. So they didn't know they didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to do. They told her that she's converted and he's a Kohen and it's a problem. So what do you do in a case like this? Rav Soloveitchik had a case like this. He wasn't dealing with a child. It's a famous case where they were in love and Rav Soloveitchik, he couldn't find a way to permit it. And that's when he said I forget what his exact language, maybe David Eisen's with us, remembers the exact language. The Rav said, we have to surrender. Yeah, that's what he said. Sometimes we have to surrender. You can't always find a heter. Today, maybe they'd find, they'd say the person's not really a Kohen, that sort of thing. There's been some famous, infamous cases like that. But the Rav could not find a heter, however much he looked, and he said, we have to surrender. In a case like this, this is the halacha, what can we do? But in this case, is there an opening? And Rabbi Greenblatt, it was made more complicated because the girl said, if she cannot get married with an Orthodox rabbi, they're going to get married civilly. They're in love, and she's from an Orthodox family, but she's going to marry him. It's as simple as that. And then he goes on to say it's a difficult case because this is their only daughter. And he says if they get married in a civil case, she'll be lost to them. This might even be a Haredi family. I mean, she'll be lost to them. Maybe it'll be such an incredible break that they're violating halacha. The family wants nothing to do with them. And then Rabbi Greenblatt says, and it could be that they'll stop being observant. It could be they're going to get married, and they'll stop being observant. There are cases of Orthodox people who marry Kohanim who marry. So they're doing wrong, but it doesn't mean now they should be Mechal Shabbos and things like that. Things like this happen. So Rabbi Greenblatt says, I investigated the matter to see whether I could find a permission. And he thought, well, first of all, maybe the mother of the adopted girl was Jewish. And then there's no problem at all. But it could be that she's not Jewish. And in America, generally, unless you get from a Jewish adoption, if you get from regular adoption, we have to assume the kid is not Jewish. That's the majority. He explains that there's a dispute in the Talmud between two sages, the Chachamim and Rashbi, Rishon Yochai. Rishon Yochai holds that if you convert the child under 3 years old, the child, the adult, later will be an adult, can marry a Kohen. The problem is the Shulchan Aruch, not just the Shulchan Aruch. We don't decide like that. It's not just the Shulchan Aruch. It's all the halachic sources. So what do you do? Apparently, this is the Shulchan Aruch, and this is the accepted halacha from the Rambam, everyone. So what do you do? However, then he says, when there's a suspicion or a danger that she is going to, if we say she can't get married, she's going to marry civilly, and she'll leave Judaism. There's always a terim if we're afraid if we don't do something, the people will end up rejecting Judaism. He says there's a responsive in Yagdil Torah, that was a Torah journal that came out in Russia, that Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski permitted a conversion, permitted a marriage in such a case when the girl was converted under 3 years old in order that she remain in Judaism and we don't create all sorts of problems. If she'd marry, the children and of the Kohen would be Chalom. In other words, we hold like Rav Shir Bar Yochai. If Rav Chaim Ozer said that, that would be an amazing source. The problem is that there is no such tshuva Rav Chaim Ozer that I know of. There's definitely nothing in Yad Gil Torah. And no one's been able to find a response of Rav Chaim Ozer. Rabbi Greenblatt was citing from memory. And I have to say that it doesn't exist. Now, if this was the only thing he cited, I think we would have to agree that Rabbi Greenblatt's heter does not stand. But it's not the only thing. But at least in this aspect, it's not true. And then he cites the commentary of Chacham Shlomo, on the Shulchan Aruch, which understands, he says that there's in Shas HaTchak there might be a room to permit. He doesn't actually say that. What he does is he interprets the Beis Shmuel, who interprets Rashi as saying that. Okay. Second point, which is not 100% accurate. But then comes the important thing. And that is, hold on. He says as follows. The Gamkin Moriva Rabbi Moreno Harav Hagon Ramosha Feinstein. He says, my teacher Ramosha Feinstein, in a similar question, told me that I can permit and not to embarrass a Jewish girl and her family, and then make it create a situation that the children will no longer be kohenim. So he's saying that in a very similar case, a case of dealing with a child converted under. Three, Rav Moshe told me that we can permit it, and he's going to explain why you can permit it. So here you have the big question. What do you do? Rabbi Greenblatt says, Rav Moshe told me this, and yet there's nothing in print. So people are always going to say, well, you can't rely on it. Whenever people cite something radical from they heard, even if they heard personally, we assume we don't accept it. Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer said as follows. The book over there, but he said that most stories you hear about Gedolim are not true. And when someone says "Bedidi Haveuvda," it happened with me and this Gadol, then vaday it's not true. So this isn't a story of a Gadol, but Rabbi Greenblatt's saying he heard. We all know that oral teachings are always very difficult because people misunderstand. If we would accept every time someone said something, it would be a problem. And we know that sometimes the great rabbi comes out and says, I didn't mean that. So on the other hand, one of the Dayanim listening to us, he turned to another Dayan. And this is Rabbi Landesman in Muncie. You know, he's head of a big based in there. And Rabbi Landesman, a student of Rav Moshe, said as follows. He says about Rabbi Greenblatt, I knew him, and he was very careful and medakdek. He would come once a month from Memphis to the east side, Meshach Shnei Yamin, for 2 days to bring, I don't know what years he's referring to, but he would come for 2 days to present all his doubts before his Rebbe, Rav Moshe. And it was also known that Rav Moshe paskened a number of times ways that were not meant for the public, but were private psakim, and therefore everything is possible. And I have no personal knowledge about this, but Rabbi Landesman does not see this as crazy, as just out of the fold sort of type stuff. He says that Rav Moshe was known for often giving psakim that were private, that and we have some ideas, some examples of this in the new books, Mesoras Moshe. We have material there which does not appear in the Igros Moshe. I was even told by a big student of Rav Moshe that he permitted the daughter of a convert, the daughter of a convert is not supposed to marry a kohen, according to the Shulchan Aruch. If they do get married, they don't split them up. But there is a Rav Moshe held that in a case where they're already in love or something, you can, it's okay to do the marriage because that's sort of like the diavad. And that's incidentally what Rav Yosef holds. But you do not see this in Igros Moshe. The Igros Moshe, when he deals with it, he just says that they can't be married. Furthermore, turning off stoves on Shabbos. You will not find anywhere in the Igros Moshe that says you could turn off a gas stove, not Shabbos and Yom Tov. And yet we know that Rav Moshe held that you could turn off a gas stove on Yom Tov. And that was originally a private psakim, but everyone asked him, so everyone knows it. So we have examples of this. So he says Rav Moshe permitted it. And then he says, and this I find, this I don't know what to make of this, uvashas adchak, in an emergency situation, like in the case you asked about, efshar v'psok k'rashbi, he said in an emergency case, we can decide like Roshim Bar Yochai, Iskaira Pachos Migimoshanim, Mutarla Lihina Sela Kohen, that if she converted under three, she can marry a Kohen. The reason why this is so significant is that, yes, we always believe in relying on Das Yachid's individual opinions, outlying opinions in emergency cases. If you ever look in the cases of Aguna, Mamzerus, cases like this, even if the Shulchan Aruch says one thing, if let's say the Shach says something and all the other postings are different, we can rely on the Shach, or we can rely on the Shlomo Luria, or maybe we can rely even on a Rishon. However, my understanding has always been that that's always post-Talmud. If the Shulchan Aruch says one thing and you're able to find, let's say the Meiri says something, well, even though we don't hold like Meiri, in this emergency case, we can go to Meiri. But here Rabbi Greenblatt is saying that even though the opinion of Rashbi in the Gemara is rejected in an emergency, we can actually go back to the Gemara even and use a rejected case. Well, that's what Maseches Ediyos says, that the reason rejected opinions are still mentioned is because a future Beis Din might have need of them. However, historically, if you look in the responsa literature, I can't remember offhand cases where even in a Shas HaBachak, they say, well, let's go back to a rejected view in the Talmud, even though that's what Maseches Ediyos says. Most assume that what Maseches Ediyos is referring to is a future Sanhedrin can look at that opinion. But to say that we today can go back and adopt the rejected opinion, That's an interesting position. And then he goes on, and he quotes a Sefer Edus Yisrael, which also he says has a permission to, in the same case, in order not to cause difficulty to the parents, that is, allow a Kohen to marry someone converted under three. I don't know what Edus Yisrael means. There's a book by Rav Henkin, Edus Yisrael. There's nothing in that book. I've looked in all the Sfarim Edus Yisrael. I could not find anything as well. And then he says, "Til Panti the Posek Gadol Beretz Yisrael." I called a great Posek in Eretz Yisrael. This is 2002. Who's the great Posek? Maybe it's Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. Maybe it's, I don't know who would be the great Posek he called in 2002. I'm not sure. I'm going to be publishing soon something from Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg. Wait till you see this. Something Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg writes about Rav Gorin. Whole three pages about how Rav Gorin. How great he was. He says, I called a great posek in Eretz Yisrael last week. V'hiskim lehetzer. And l'chinatati. And he agreed with my permission of al b'kesh lo for same shmo. But he asked that I not say who he is, his name publicly. We're told, lo saguru, you're not supposed to be afraid. But sometimes rabbis are afraid. V'chein ani lo b'far same shema b'churi. He says, I'm not going to publicize the name of the girl and her parents, because when I print this in volume 9, I don't want them to be embarrassed. And therefore, I've left out the names. And I've left out the names. And now he says, the Rabbanim, the rabbis in Buro, who agreed to marry them. I'm leaving out. So obviously, they were being married in America. the person who's going to marry them, or maybe more than one rabbi. He says the rabbis. So they're, and then they should marry, etc. And so is my opinion. What do you make of a tshuva like this? On the one hand, the sources, it's a radical view that's allowing halacha l'maisa, people under converts under three, to be married in emergency cases. Not l'chachtil, you're not going to make a shidduch, but if people are already involved. The sources he cites, the Eidos Yisrael and the Yagdil Torah of Chaim Ozer, are non-existent. On the other hand, he testifies that Rav Moshe said it, and he says he called a great posek, and he himself is a great posek. And we're not dealing with a kal, we're dealing with an authentic posek who was asked shaylos from all over America for 50 years, or 40 years. One respected by all the gedolim. This could become a precedent. We'll see if it becomes a precedent. I did, and we'll end with this. In the note, I said I've never found anyone agreeing with this, but Rabbi Pinchas Toledano. Pinchas Toledano was the chacham of the Sephardic community in London. The Sephardim there, they're not ruled by the chief rabbi. They've had their own chacham. Before there was a chief rabbi, there was a chacham going way back, hundreds of years in London. Now he's the chief rabbi of Amsterdam, the Sephardic chief rabbi. And he has a number of volumes of tshuvot called Brit Shalom, Rishon. And he writes in volume 3, Evan Ezer Simon Vav, that in a case where they already are married, that is, according to the halacha, if you marry a convert and a kohen, they have to be divorced. It's not like the other case I mentioned where the avad they can remain. He allows them to remain together after they're already married. Why? He says, because we can rely on Rashbi, Rashi Meirachai, if they're already married. It's the same problem I had before. What do you mean rely on Rashi Meirachai? He's rejected. Are we going to now say that there's a shita that you can eat the chicken with milk, so all of a sudden in an emergency case we can bring it back? Unless I'm missing something, and I know we have many Talmidei Chachamim who are listening, who are going to be listening later and watching on YouTube, give me examples where you have people saying what Rabbi Greenblatt says and Rabbi Pinchas Toledano says, that in an emergency, we can rely on rejected views in the Talmud. I don't know offhand, I don't know examples of this, but this might be the most significant tshuva in the book, in if it will have an impact, because this could change. If it was Rav Moshe writing it himself, no question it would be the most important, because it would change halachic practice by every modern Orthodox and every Haredi rabbi in America, basically, because now they'd have a case like this, they would be allowed to marry them. What you have here is Rabbi Greenblatt telling you Rav Moshe said it. That's not going to carry the same weight, and we have to just wait and see in the coming years what is going to happen with this tshuva, what type of impact. Just like we're now seeing, I don't know what the RCA rabbis do when a kohen wants to marry a girl whose father is was non-Jewish. Shulchan Aruch says you can't do that. On the other hand, Rav Vad Yosef, Rav Masas, says you can if they're already involved. What do the RCA rabbis do? I don't know. This tshuva has the potential to change practices among rabbis. Will it? I don't think so, because it's not Rav Moshe himself. With all the respect you can give to Rabbi Greenblatt, I think people are going to look at it and say, you already have problems because the sources don't exist, that the two sources he cites, and we don't know the posek that he called in Eretz Yisrael, and maybe he misunderstood what Rav Moshe said. It's just, no matter who it is, even a great rabbi like Rabbi Greenblatt, if you don't have Rav Moshe's signature agreeing to this, I don't think it can change halachic practice, but I could be wrong. And I ask all rabbis who are going to listen, let me know if you've heard anything. In addition to the couple of dayanim who listen, we have many, many rabbis from all over the world. Have you had any cases like this where you were given a heter to marry? And when I say a heter, I don't mean a heter because you conclude that the kohen is not a real kohen. A heter based solely upon the fact that the girl who was converted was under 3 years old. If anyone can let me know about that, I'll be appreciative. Okay, so we end. We'll pick up, obviously, next class as we go on. More interesting stuff, including a complete revision to what people assume a view of Rav Avad Yosef is, etc. All sorts of interesting stuff. Let me take the questions. I went a little too far, but let's see. I'll read them out loud, as always. And for those who came on late, you see Rabbi Kelman has a link there for the the poll he wants to know about different types of classes in Hebrew. Again, I'll just remind everyone, you're getting great stuff here, I think. I don't have to include myself in this, but just the program is being offered. If everyone can make a donation on the website, we all would appreciate it. Rabbi Kelman, Torah in Motion are really the originators. Before there was Zoom, the first people, before YU Torah was, well, YU Torah wasn't live. The very first online classes like this, interactive Torah classes, were done by Torah in Motion many years ago. Some people listening were with us at the very beginning. You remember the technology was pretty good. It wasn't like Zoom, but it was pretty good. And so he's the originator of this and still going strong. And he's giving it free now on the website and on YouTube. So it would be great if everyone, $18, $36, 100, whatever you want to, I know he would appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, David Eisen. It's already to August 25th. In Israel, it's the 25th. You're right. You're right. I'm looking at the wrong thing. I'm like Yehud HaLevi. My heart is in the East. You're absolutely right. The second time I did this, the 5th of Elul. Yesterday, I'm sure many of you know. If you don't, you should know. The Shlosha Be'Elul, it was Rav Kook's yahrzeit, and it was a big yahrzeit. He died in 1935. So if you're in Israel, I'm sure you knew about this. Someone texted me privately that from reading the OU document, he's convinced that there's nothing wrong with women rabbis. They assume that there's nothing wrong with, on occasion, being a rabbi. That is, you can occasionally run a service like a funeral. It's the language they use is ongoing. You could be a scholar, you could preach from the pulpit, but on a continuing basis, they don't see that as acceptable. As a Cohen and as a Rappaport, David says, does that make Rav Chaim a direct descendant of the Shach? Is Rabbi Rappaport a Cohen? He doesn't say it in the Sefer. Usually they say Chaim a Cohen Rappaport. He doesn't say that. So I don't know if he's a Cohen or not. Rabbi Rappaport used to be, at Chovei Torah for a number of years. He came in. He hasn't been there in probably 10 years. He hasn't been there, and I believe it's ideological reasons. It's a little too much to the left for him. But yes, as a Chabadnik, Chabadnikim speak everywhere. They speak in Reform shuls and conservative shuls. So there's not a problem with that from their perspective. Rabbi Kelman says, yes, for those interested, you can watch a panel discussion on LGBT Orthodoxy, Rabbi Rappaport. It's the most downloaded, and on YouTube, it's the most popular show. Very interesting on YouTube. David says, Rabbi Rappaport opens his tshuva to me with a beautiful melitza, choker, charif, ubaki, mishnato, kav, v'naki. Exactly. And if you, Rabbi, it's rhyming. It's very nice. If you go online, in particular on Otsar HaChachma, you read as many articles. I asked him once where he gets this style from. He says, as a youth, he started doing this. He started writing with these Hebraisms, and then he just became an expert in it. And you see, he's beautiful melitzas. iPad asks, is the Shaddai written on the back of the mezuzah parchment an example of holy names and protection? The Rambam, it is, but the Rambam says you can't put anything on the inside of the mezuzah. If you look in Trachtenberg's book on Jewish magic and superstition, you see examples of the holy names and the angels' names that used to go on the inside of the mezuzah. Today, no one does that. Instead, we don't just put, we also put the letters, the muchaz, we put that, but it's on the outside. So the Rambam says you're allowed to put that on the outside. Shaddai, you could say it's not about magic, also it's about remembering God. But the b'muchaz there, that's magical, angelic sort of stuff, divine names sort of things. That's on the outside. So the Rambam says, if you put it on the inside, you're a heretic. Or he didn't say you're a heretic, you have no share in the world to come, because you make a mitzvah like a kameya. But the Rambam says you could put it on the outside. Why put it on the outside? Because the people, the Rambam is very tolerant. If people want to believe nonsense, that's okay. If it affects the ikar, the mitzvah, if it affects, it gets involved in principles of faith, if it affects the mitzvah itself, as it would if you put it on the actual cloth on the inside, underneath the writing, that he doesn't want. But if you want to put it on the outside of the mezuzah, he thinks it's nonsense, but it's okay. People can do it. It's like the Rambam says that angels have no physical form. The Rambam does not believe that angels have a physical form, but he says if people want to believe that, they can believe that. You don't need to correct them. It's not like if people believe that God is a physical form, you need to correct them from their errors. That's why he teaches us a lesson you shouldn't tolerate. There's someone, a good friend of mine, but he gets very annoyed when these people come to town and do things like these magicians and these people, these self-styled Kabbalists come to town. And they can read your palm and read your forehead, and you come to them for brachas. And of course, if you give them a nice payment, you'll get a better bracha. I mentioned before the Rav Kaduri, who was a real Mekubal, said that you can always know who a phony Mekubal is when you can't get in to see him unless you pay money. And a real Mekubal wants to help you. But my friend gets very annoyed. If you read the Jewish Link, you might recall he's had letters there because the Jewish Link in Teaneck, the whole North Jersey, it might be the same in other parts, this newspaper, they have these giant ads about these people. There's some woman, she comes and they do this thing with molten lead. They spill it and you can get good luck from out all sorts of like Avodah Zarah and quasi-Avodah Zarah stuff. So he's always, well, I shouldn't say Avodah Zarah, quasi-Avodah Zarah, because Avodah Zarah, he'd be right. But he likes to attack that, say it's nonsense. We had in my town, someone he's subsequently has passed away, but he put on the show listserv because they announced the visit. We don't get so many. It's like the five towns are coming every week. We don't get that many. But he put a thing on the listserv how it's a disgrace. We're an intelligent community, and et cetera, et cetera. But I said to him, and I said to my friend, Liz and Teaneck, that the Rambam is more tolerant than you, because the Rambam makes it clear that people can go on with their superstitions. If it doesn't affect basic Judaism, he's okay with this. You have to ask Rav Schechter about this because he's very much against the red ribbons. But is he against it because it's idolatry? What's the idolatry? No one today uses it for idolatry. The Tosefta mentions it, but today the Gemara says, the halacha is that if they don't practice that idolatry, it's not idolatry. It could be that Rav Schechter thinks it's just stupid, or Rav Schechter holds, he has this in Nefesh HaRav, that the Rav said it's usher to be stupid. And therefore, you can't be stupid. But the Rambam apparently held you could be stupid because the Rambam says that tipshim do this, but if they don't do it, the ikkar mitzvah, it's okay. So if anyone, you can ask. Rav Schechter has said it's avodah zarah, but you have to probe a little bit. Is it really avodah zarah? Because no one does it today. It's like the people who say you can't use a birthday candle because at one time they found that it was used for idolatry, this sort of thing. Today, no one does it. Mel Baranolt says, David Dessa's son is getting married. Yofarf was this past Shabbos. Nice. So a mazel tov to David Dessa. When you see him, Mel, you can tell him, and I could send it to him. I haven't spoken to him in many, many years, that you saw a picture of him with us in Egypt. He was actually my roommate in BMT. Yeah. David says, regarding the Rambam's position on amulets, his commentary to the Mishnah refers to an amulet made by an expert, defines such an amulet as one that's proven to cure three times. Perhaps this is not a contradiction, as Rambam was certain no such amulet existed. Yeah. David raises a good point. The Rambam, we know, didn't believe in amulets and all these things, and yet in the Gemara, he speaks about, in his commentary on the Mishnah, and also, I think in the Mishnah here also, he speaks about a Kameya Mumcha, an amulet that cures, that you can use, like on Shabbos and things. What do you mean an amulet that cures? An amulet that has proven itself. He didn't believe in this. It could be that this is an example. I say this in my book, Sites of My Mommies and Superstition, where I deal with that it could be that he was two things. Either he's simply citing the halacha as it appears, even though he doesn't believe it could ever happen. I quote another example of that. But it also could be psychosomatic. The Rambam says that you can recite an incantation over someone, even though it has no value, even on Shabbos, when it's not Devarim B'Teilim, so you shouldn't be able to recite that on Shabbos, because he says the person might feel it has value. So it could be, what does it mean, a Kameya that has cured people? It means that people think it has cured people. But you can see more discussion in my book, my chapter there on Rambam and Superstition. That's a famous halacha where the Rambam speaks about a proven amulet, and yet how could the Rambam believe in a proven amulet? Justin asked, Kibush is what kind of conquest? As we said, what did Ariel Sharon do? If Israel were to move into Egypt and conquer it, Mohammed Smith or even Mohammed Rishus, the Rambam says, then you can live there. Not only could you live there then, you could live there permanently, even when Israel withdraws its troops. That's what we heard last week. David says, wasn't Daniel Kurtzer the ambassador to Egypt when you were there? No, Daniel Kurtzer was the ambassador to Egypt in the 1990s under Clinton. Well, I was in Egypt three times. So yes, he was the ambassador to Egypt when I was there. I was there twice in the 90s. So he was the ambassador to Egypt. No, I was there once in the 90s. He was the ambassador when I was in the 90s. But there was the Shomer Shabbos and one kosher embassy in Egypt as well, at least the main kitchen, because I thought that the Israeli embassies were all kosher everywhere. I thought it was like the rule. It turns out it's not. I learned this, I was in Prague, and the previous ambassador, are you related to him, David? Norm Eisen, the American ambassador to the Czech Republic under Obama. So he came to shul on Shabbos. He was a Shomer Shabbos. He's like conservadox. He said to me that that the only embassy that's kosher in Prague is his embassy. And I said, what about the Israeli embassy? And he said, no, they're not kosher. And subsequently, I learned that the embassies don't have to be kosher. When I was until the last trip in Israel, I've been to Israel probably 20 times, I thought that all public places in Israel had to be closed on Shabbos. I was down in Masada for like the fifth or sixth time, and I saw the sign there that it's open on Shabbos. The restaurant's there, the space is open, and now I learned there's all sorts of museums open on Shabbos in Israel run by the government. I didn't know that. Yes, so Mel says he was ambassador long after, and then he became ambassador to Israel, and then he was finished with ambassador to Israel. He became the commissioner of the Israel Baseball Association, which unfortunately didn't last very long, but that's what he did. Rabbi Moshe Katz says the age of three is not arbitrary. It's because under three, the act is not viewed halachically as a sexual act. Yeah, but the question is why not? Well, why is three, and why did they pick three? I always assume because they thought that societies that were full of sexual immorality began this at the age of three. So it was a question of metzius. Okay, so David's Eisen says he's reviewing Rashbi's position, doesn't see it's explicitly rejected by the Gemara. Okay, thank you for that. Let me sharpen my language. I meant it is a Talmudic position which is rejected. In other words, there's no Rishon that adopts this position. So I agree. What I said was incorrect. If it was rejected by the Gemara, perhaps they wouldn't. But still, do we have examples where every Rishon who deals with it rejects the position? And we still think that you can revive it? But it's not. My language was imprecise. Thank you, David. It would be interesting to know what Rav Grinbach's position was, or Dorothy Hoffman's tshuva, that permitted a Kohen living with a non-Jewish woman to marry her after she converts. Well, good question. I don't know what we would say. In that case, Rav Gorin held, let me correct you, Dave, and you didn't speak, you could have been sharper. He did not believe that the non-Jewish woman could be married to the Kohen. What they said is that they could live together. She would be his Pilegesh. Look in the tshuva there. When the woman converts to Judaism, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman rules that they can remain together because it's better for a Kohen to be with a non-Jewish woman as a Pilegish, the sin is less than with a being married to a non-Jew. And furthermore, he said, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman says that you can't marry them because halachically you can't have a marriage by definition. And it's a worse sin if they were married if you go ahead and do this. The Rav, when he was told this view of Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, he did not believe it's possible. The post-take could have said that. But Rav David Tzvi Hoffman did say that, and Rav Gorin relies on this. If you look into Chumin about 15 years ago, there's a letter from Rav Gorin to Rav Yecheskel Abramsky, and he relies on this halacha lemaisa. The question, which we dealt with, if you go back, those of you who are just watching on YouTube or are new listeners, you can go back to the old classes on Rav online, on the website, Torah and Moshe, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman. The question is, how could Rav David Tzvi Hoffman convert a woman who's then going to live with a Kohen, even though she's a convert? She's violating halacha. Don't we assume that when you convert, you have to accept of all halacha? And there, Rav David Tzvi Hoffman says that as long as she doesn't say explicitly, I reject the halacha, we know she's going to reject it, but she doesn't say explicitly, that's considered Kabbalah HaMitzvot. Rav David Tzvi Hoffman, the greatest posek in Germany in the early part of the 20th century, his book of Psakim is one of the standard ones of the 20th century, explicitly rejects the idea that acceptance of the mitzvot means you have to believe you're going to follow all of them. That gets back to Rabbi Amsalem's position. couple more. You said he wrote a sefer on Birkas Kohanim, so I assumed he is a Kohen. I also assume, because Rappaports are almost always Kohen, but I looked in the before at the title page, and it doesn't say here. Before, when I opened it, I looked, and usually it will say Chaim ben Roshnir Zalman HaKohen Rappaport. It doesn't say that. So I don't know. Not all Rappaports are. I'll ask him if he's a, I'll make a note of it. I'll ask him if he's a Kohen. Rabbi Kalman says, Rav Schachter told us, in a case of divorce, when one parent is frum but crazy and one observant and normal, the kid should be raised by the normal parent. Yeah, that's makes sense. I think it makes sense, although many people would reject that and say you're putting a kid who's with a parent who's not observant. But if you know what could happen if kids are raised by crazy parents, And finally, David Eisen says that Rav Goren officiated at Helen Seidman's chuppah. There were other issues with Helen Seidman. She was living on an irreligious kibbutz, so she said she's vegetarian. So what does that mean, she's a vegetarian? There's still the kalim are not proper. But although we have good studies of the Langer case by the late Eitam Henkin, Rabbi Eitam Henkin, Hashem Yikom Damo, we do not have a study of the Helen Seidman case. It was just another thing that Rabbi Goren did. Norm Eisen, I don't know. You can follow him. When he was the ambassador in Prague, he gave me his email. He gave me his card with his private contact information. And I'll just end with one story. Those of you who are with us, this was our first trip. Was it the second trip? Or by Kalman, the first trip or the second trip? I think the second trip. It was the first trip?
To where?
To Prague, where we met the ambassador.
Eisen. That was our, no, I wasn't on that trip.
Oh, it was the second trip. So, I think I'll just end with this story. So we are a bunch of Orthodox people, many from the Northeast, other places. We know their politics. And we know they're not such fans. They weren't such fans of Barack Obama. So Eisen was with us on Shabbos. I got to be friendly with him. One of the chairs even has his name. It was a big deal. He walked to shul every Shabbos with the security. He was at daily morning minyan. He came, he had three security guards. That was the first time I realized, I always thought that American security personnel protect you when you go overseas. And no, he was protected by Czech security, and he said that even Israeli ambassador, Czech security. So Shabbos, Shalosh Shudas, he's with us. We had Shalosh Shudas, and then we went back to the shul, and we're hanging out there. Not the shul, the community center upstairs. We davened mincha, he davened with us. And one person in particular, and then maybe a couple others, start challenging him good-naturedly, but then it got not such good-naturedly, why he is Obama supporter. Does he know what Obama's doing for Israel and how Obama's an enemy of the Jews and this and that? And it sort of was not the right thing to do. With Shabbos, you know, we're guests there, and he's the ambassador, and he kept saying, jokingly saying, it's Shabbos, let's not talk about this on Shabbos. But so all I can say is, if you're ever with a person who supports a policy or a politician that you don't like, and it's Shabbos, this is the week, it's not during the week, so no politics on Shabbos, or you'll put our ambassador, who's making a big Kiddush Hashem there, in a difficult situation, and he couldn't exactly tell the people off. Okay, everyone, thank you all for being here. I will see you next week. Rabbi Kalman, final words?
Thank you. No,